comes. So right now, let's go back into what the Templars were attempting to do. Now, you make an intriguing observation in the Thrice Great Hermetica book that around the Templar era, there were actually some attempts to create a Hermetic state or a Templar state. Mm-hmm. And that received a major pushback at the time. And I find this so interesting, and it makes sense to me, because there's this amazing release of this ancient wisdom seemingly out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that later, the Rosetta Stone is part of that knowledge spree also. It's almost as if these esoteric teachings are being poured into society to break up these power circles that have become archaic.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, the idea of a Templar state, this is the other thing that makes the Albigensian Crusade so extremely suspicious, because I think it was King Juan II of Aragon that on his death willed his entire kingdom, you know, the area around Barcelona in modern-day Spain, willed that whole kingdom to the Templars.
Huh.
You know, which would have set up their state. And then you have the fact that just across the Pyrenees Mountains, you've got this heavy Templar presence in the Cathar region of the Languedoc. All right. So in other words, it looks to me like, yes, the Templars were trying to do something using all that power and all their wealth to literally, you know, thumb the nose at the very institution that had given them that power. And the papacy turns right around and, you know, smashes it. But had they been successful in doing that, had they been successful in creating their own kingdom and then coupling it somehow with the Cathar region, this would have been, you know, the right in the middle of the papacy's backyard in the most prosperous region of Europe to boot at the time.
Right.
This would have unhinged the power structure of the day. Talk about revolutionary. You know, there would not have been anything even remotely like it. Even the Renaissance, with the huge change in cosmological outlook that it brought about, even that didn't do anything so much revolutionary politically. That took some time for that to work out in European history. This would have been huge. This would have been epochal.
Yeah, just amazing. Well, it would have been this Templar superstate.
Yes.
And it would have incorporated all of these fantastic teachings and findings that they had discovered.
Right.
And then after that, they're suppressed. And years later, there are little fragments circulating around. And you can almost get the impression out there from these incomplete parts.
Right.
You know, Rosicrucian teachings, esoterica, these mystical
right.
influences of something left over and trying to carry on, trying to reconstitute once again.
Right. Well, the Rosicrucians are very interesting, I think. because if you read the manifestos, one of the most interesting things that they state is that the symbol of this secret college is what? It's a red cross on a white background.
Yeah.
You know, this is the corporate logo of the Templars. You know, the other one being a red rose on a white background, you know. And that's very symbolic because, you know, the whole expression sub rosa, under the rose, meant back at that time that these were matters that were to be kept secret and confidential. It was the jargon of espionage of the day, okay?
Interesting.
So, you know, even that symbolism is an indicator that these manifestos are talking about not just a secret college, but they're talking about a secret intelligence agency, you know?
Right, yeah.
So the very fact that you're talking in those manifestos and using those types of symbols, we have to remember that when the Templars were suppressed, the decree of the Council of Vienne in France stated that any display of Templar symbols or insignia was an excommunicable offense, and it was a reserved excommunication. In other words, in the parlance of canon law, what that meant was you didn't have to go through the process of an ecclesiastical court and have the local bishop excommunicate you, just doing it did it.
I see, yeah.
You see? So this becomes hugely significant if you have these manifestos now using the symbolism. And let's not forget who else uses this symbolism proudly and openly displayed on the sails of the three ships that he sails to America to, quote, discover the place. He's, you know, Christopher Columbus.
Columbus, yeah.
Boldly displaying these Templar insignia, you know, with the collusion of Ferdinand and Isabella.
Right. Well, you know, let's talk about Columbus here.
Sure.
You do a lot of very interesting analysis about Columbus, and one of the things you do is tie the Templars' search to these cartographic traditions of ancient maps, and you have some very interesting references in there to Admiral Pere Ries and his book on sea lore.
Oh, yeah.
And he says some very interesting things that relate to Columbus,
oh, yeah.
who he calls Columbo.
Columbo, yeah. A Genoese.
Yes.
That went to the Bay of Spain, you know, the King of Spain, and had these maps and had this book. You know, Pere Ries is very explicit. He said Columbus had a map and he had a book that he's showing Ferdinand and Isabella. And so let's back up now and find out exactly what may be going on.
Yeah.
If you look at the Pere Ries map, which was composed by this Turkish admiral around circa 1530. It's uncanny in that it displays the coast of South America and then Antarctica.
Yeah, wow.
Accurately. You know, and Antarctica hasn't even been discovered yet.
So it's completely unexplained.
It's completely unexplained. And Pere Ries goes on to explain, well, I made this map by comparing it to other old sources. So, in other words, you know, here's this Turkish admiral sitting there in Constantinople ransacking the Byzantine Empire's imperial archives, and he's coming up with all these old maps, and he's making this map that shows Antarctica. Okay. So, there is, in other words, evidence that there was a secret cartographic tradition. Okay. Now, somewhere along the line, Columbus gets a hold of it.
Right.
So, we have to figure out how. Okay. So this is where it gets interesting. Columbus is from Genoa. Genoa was the great banking maritime rival of Venice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So you have both Venice and Genoa at a certain point in their history had these quarters in Constantinople, ghettos we'd call them now, where the Eastern Roman emperors had granted them wharves and docking facilities in Constantinople and taxation immunities to conduct their trade.
Okay.
Now, this means, in my opinion, that especially after the Fourth Crusade, the influence of these Italian city-states over Byzantium is going to be enormous, and therefore they're probably going to have access at some point to what's in the imperial archives. So why is this important? Because at one time, if you go back in history, the Byzantine Empire stretched all over Mesopotamia, Asia Minor, and then down into Egypt.
Right.
Which means they probably had access to whatever was left of the Library of Alexandria.
Yes.
So you've got a cartographic tradition that's probably secret in Byzantium for a very good reason. Byzantium sits astride the trading routes of the world. And even though the emperors of the Roman Empire may have known, well, there's this whole world over there across the Great Sea, but we don't want anybody to know about it because if anybody knows about it, our power, it's gone. You know?
Exactly.
So what happens is this cartographic tradition gets transmitted, I think, by the Knights Hospitallers, by the Knights Templars, to Genoa and Venice. And this is how Columbus gets a hold of it. And it's even more murky because when you look at Columbus and his dealings with Ferdinand and Isabella, I mean, you know, this guy's a piece of work. Because there's a certain point in the capitulations, the documents, the contracts that are signed between Ferdinand and Isabella on the one hand and Columbus on the other, that indicates that Columbus had some prior knowledge of the New World, and at one point in the convocation between Columbus and Ferdinand and Isabella, she points out to him, "Sir, it's almost as if you have been there before."
That's great. I love that.
You know, in other words, he's not putting anything over on Queen Isabella. But, you know, she knows what's going on.
Yeah.
So, in other words, what we have is a very plausible case that Columbus undertook secret voyages to the New World before his voyage of discovery.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and again, Peary Reese indicates that this is the case.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that he happened in 1485.
In 1485, not 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So what we really have with Columbus's 1492 voyage is the agreement between Ferdinand and Isabella, Christopher Columbus representing what? Representing that Genoese banking Knights Hospitaller interest and the papacy, that it's time to let all of this out. Okay? And we have to put ourselves in the mentality now of the Italian city-states in northern Italy, Genoa and Venice in particular, because what this secret cartographic tradition would have represented to them was the end of their trading empire and the end, therefore, of their financial power. And if they're going to survive, if they're going to preserve that power, they now have to do so, number one, by, so to speak, moving shop and acquiring ports, facilities, or proxy actors able to do this. So what do you see Genoa doing? Genoa's backing Columbus. Genoa is backing Ferdinand and Isabella, along with, guess who else? Florence, the Medicis. Mm-hmm. And then what does Venice do? Well, they've been kind of cut out of the game.
Right.
So they're very clever, you know, being Venetians. They move their operation gradually northward through Germany, into another city in a swamp called Amsterdam,
right.
And then from Amsterdam across the channel to England. So in other words, these Italian oligarchs are also behind this in a major way.
Right, right.
You know, Venice in particular just fascinates the daylights out of me because they are, you know, they're the perfide Albion of the day. You know, the other thing I point out in Thrice Great Hermetica is there is a bit of evidence that Venice actually undertook a voyage to the New World. And let's be frank here. Let's go back to the Templars. Everybody wants to know, the Templars had this immense treasure, supposedly,
mm-hmm.
that disappeared, apparently, just in time, conveniently enough, when Philip le Bel decides to shut down the order in France. So where did it go? Where's this big, huge Templar fleet that used to be in La Rochelle, you know?
Yeah.
So this all goes missing, and he shows up, you know, in the preceptories in Paris, and they're empty, okay? So what happens here? Where are the Templar records? You know, where's the account books? You can't run an international banking concern like the Templar Order without keeping account books.
Hmm.
Okay? And this, again, this is something you don't find academics asking. Well, the Templar archives were all over in Rhodes, or they were all over in Cyprus, and, you know, nonsense like this.
Right.
They just don't think. So Venice, back to the Templars, Venice is allied with the Templars. Let's assume for a moment, Daniel, that the Templars were making voyages to the New World. Okay?
Yeah.
Let's assume in doing so that they run across a bunch of North American Indians who are mining and producing gold and silver. They bring it back to Europe. This, to me, may be the key to why Venice becomes the bullion capital of Europe.
Interesting.
Because Venice, if you look at Venice's financial activity, I mean, they're ruthless.
Yeah.
If you look at their financial activity, the way that they were able to maintain their power and literally take down their competitors was through some pretty filthy manipulation of the European bullion markets.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you've got a secret supply of gold and silver bullion coming in, courtesy of your allies, the Templars, that's a very convenient thing by which to be able to do that. And incidentally, for all the academics out there, let's remember what I said earlier. The Council of Ten was founded by Venice 3 years after the suppression of the Templars. So I suspect that if you dig long and hard enough in the Venetian state archives, you're going to find some old Templar account books. But nobody has thought to look for them there.
Huh.
You see, I'm guessing here. I mean, that's just a speculation. But
okay. Well, we can see the story here is taking a major turn because this idea of the Templars in America is just fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
And what were they doing there?
Yeah, a lot. I mentioned the Kensington Knight. You know, there's this knight carved on a rock in Massachusetts it's real, it's legit, it's there.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at this guy, he's dressed out in full armor. He's got this big, huge broadsword that he's holding with a great big cross on it. You know, in other words, it looks Templar.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to this, you've got that very bizarre report of modern Zeno in the 16th century that maintains that a couple of his relatives 2 centuries before had gone up to Scotland and then journeyed over to the New World with Prince Henry Sinclair.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, you know, I think that's legitimate. A lot of academics don't, but I think it's legitimate for one very important reason, because first of all, there is a hidden cartographic tradition. And the Zeno family, interestingly enough, was when the Fourth Crusade occurred and Constantinople was sacked by the Venetians, interestingly enough, in 1204, the Venetian governor that's put in charge over in Constantinople is a member of, guess what, family, the Zeno family. Okay, he becomes the Venetian Podesta over in Constantinople. So in other words, you've got a connection between the Zeno family in Constantinople. You've got the Zenos allegedly making this voyage to the New World a century before Columbus.
Yeah.
And reporting on all this gold and stuff over there. Would that be something that Venice would do? Well, absolutely, because Venice is constantly testing these indicators of secrets secret traditions to find out if, in fact, they're true. Think of Marco Polo,
mm-hmm.
you know, another Venetian,
mm-hmm.
who, guess what, gets captured by the Genoese.
Right. Well, you make interesting references to him in that it's well known his voyages to the Orient and how he got over there and explored. But you think that he actually made it to the New World and that they basically said, don't talk about that part. Right. We're going to make it Japan.
Yeah, we're going to make it Japan. When you read Polo, he talks about having to journey he's journeying with the Chinese. That's in his book. But he talks about this being a journey that took him a year. Well, it does. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a whole year in a Chinese junk to travel across the Sea of Japan. You know.
But Joseph, you realize you have 2 fundamental tenets of history that gets taught in school. Christopher Columbus in America, 1492. This is real doctrine. And Marco
right.
Polo discovering Japan.
Japan.
So, right.
The Chinese didn't know about it already.
Interestingly enough, you come in on both of those and blow them away.
Yeah. Yeah. And the real key here is to understand that it's being blown away by looking at the indicators that there is a hidden history that's taking place behind the public narrative that we've been taught.
Yeah.
And that hidden history, the reason it's being obscured, in my opinion, is that, first of all, you do have the presence of intelligence operations. Let's just be honest. This is what they are. This is what Venice is doing. This is what the Council of Ten is for. This is what the Templars are doing. And on top of this, you also have something else very interesting. You have, as I said, you have created the mechanism in these crusading orders for the intergenerational accumulation of capital. But this is a very peculiar type of accumulation in that it is not the private property of an individual Templar knight. It is the property of the order. So in a certain sense, you can look ahead centuries to 19th and 20th century Europe and kind of see in the Templars the beginnings of what we would now call a trust and a cartel.
Right.
You see, because this is very much similar type of thinking. So in other words, this is also what's going on. And then finally, when you look at the geopolitics and financial politics of that age, what you see happening is behind Spain, behind Portugal, you've got remnants of the Templars, you've got Genoese bankers, you've got Florentine bankers that are moving their base of operations. And by the same token, you've got Venetians that are also doing all of this, and they're moving their base of operations. So you're setting up the next big centuries-long conflicts now between the European Atlantic powers and ultimately Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Venetian connection in Great Britain is particularly strong. I mean, you know, you have Giordano Bruno going up there. You have Henry VIII with his divorce. Well, who's the lawyer that he consults? He's a Venetian.
Yeah.
You know, the power politics here is very real, and we have to start looking at European history, particularly during this age, with those kinds of spectacles. Otherwise, it makes no sense. It's just one big, huge collection of names and dates, and it doesn't really mean anything. Well, there are huge geopolitical contexts going on that have affected the world we live in now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The setup is back there, and it's pretty it's pretty well obscured too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When you start thinking of obscurity, why would anyone want to obscure all this?
Right.
You know. Well, I'll tell you why. Let me give you just a little detail here. Okay. If you study medieval history, you study, you know, the conflict in northern Italy between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, all right? The pro-imperial versus the pro-papal people, all right? Well, the Guelphs are the Italian name for a family, for a clan, that across the Alps, there's a German branch of the family. They're called Welf-Aibling, all right? Now, if you look at the family of Welf, they're also tied into, in these very complex ways, into, guess what, the House of Orange in the Netherlands. So in other words, you've got this Italian, German, Dutch connection, okay? The House of Orange, of course, is brought over during the British Glorious Revolution. William Stadtholder is brought over from the Netherlands to be crowned King of England, William III. You know, War of Spanish Succession and all this stuff. And William, once he gets to England, what does he do? Very significant. What does he do?
Okay.
1694, he founds the Bank of England.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is William Stadtholder. All right. That's one little detail.
Well, it's so interesting because you link back the powerful interests of our world today with this period, and you outline how what we refer to today as the world's most powerful, wealthy families, who for the most part are having a terrible impact on the world, these families go right back to what we're discussing here.
So yeah, this is all part of this history. If we don't understand the Middle Ages and all these complicated marriage alliances going on, we're not going to make very much sense out of modern history either.
Yeah, absolutely. And understand how that ruling structure comes into being over many centuries.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we leave Columbus, though, there's one very fascinating detail that you track down about a statement by his son about him.
Well, I didn't track it down.
Okay.
I'm just reporting on this other guy's research.
You're
here.
I'm just the messenger.
I'm trying to put all this together. The guy's name was Ruggero Marino, an Italian researcher. Wonderful, wonderful research. And what he uncovered was Christopher Columbus's son, I forget what his first name was, stated that his father was of the tribe of David, something to this effect. So in other words, what he's saying there is that Christopher Columbus was part Jewish. Well, where's this coming from? You know, why would Ferdinand and Isabella, in the process of setting up the, you know, the notorious Spanish Inquisition, be turning to a Genoese Jew to back their expedition to reveal the New World and stake out Spanish claims? Well, interestingly enough, Ruggero also uncovers the fact that on Pope Innocent the Eighth's tomb in Rome, engraved on his sarcophagus is the esoteric signature of Christopher Columbus. Now, what's Columbus's signature doing on Innocent the Eighth's tomb? Now, Innocent the Eighth was... I love this. Innocent the Eighth was a fellow by the name of Giovanni Cibo. And Cibo, Cardinal Cibo, was this fellow who had both Muslim and Jewish relatives. And he's elected Pope in a conclave where the other candidate is, and here comes a key phrase, is also referred to as a knight.
Wow.
So in other words, Cibo himself, being referred to as Cavaliere, as a knight, is probably a member of either the Knights Hospitaller or may have some secret Templar connection.
Yeah.
And he's elected Pope over the other knight. And so what does Cibo do? Well, Cibo also has, shall we say, as many of the popes of the time seem to have had, a libido. Cibo, prior to being elected Pope, as a cardinal, apparently played around a bit and sired all of these children all over Europe. And it, in Ruggero's estimation, and I think he's right, Columbus may have been one of his sons. And this would be where Columbus gets his Jewishness.
Yeah.
You know? So on and on we go. You know, there's all these family connections lurking in the background of all of this.
That lines up pretty well. Very,
oh,
very
yeah,
fascinating.
It does. Yeah.
The big cover story about Columbus's voyage was that it was to find a shorter route to the Spice Islands. Why is that so ridiculous?
Well, it's ridiculous because, first of all, there's evidence that he did take a secret voyage in 1485. Piri Reis is talking about this. Mm-hmm. And Piri Reis makes it very clear that Columbus had a secret map and a secret book, and he's showing all of this to Ferdinand and Isabella. And Ferdinand and Isabella, put yourself in their shoes. Okay, there's something over there. They might have a lot of gold. And therefore we want it, but we don't want anybody else to get there. So we're going to keep all this a secret. Yeah, we'll fund you. And if anybody asks, we'll tell them, well, you're looking for another route to the Spice Islands because you think the world is round and you can get to China that way.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, nothing has changed, people. They're putting out spin here. Because remember, Columbus comes back. He says, oh, yeah, I found, you know, this new world over there. And it appears they've got some gold. And, yeah, I planted your flag. And Isabella's comment, sir, it's almost as if you've been there before, you know.
That is so great. I'm glad
you
spotlighted
it. Really is. It really is.
She lays it right out there.
She lays it right out there.
But here's an interesting, fascinating thing. These secret maps, that whole tradition, those maps are very sophisticated.
Yes.
And you'd need a pretty high technology to be able to scout out the world that way.
Right.
Far beyond the kind of ships that a guy like Columbus was using.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So where did those maps come from? Who was behind them and where did we get the technology?
Who's behind those maps? All right. You look at the medieval portolans, I forget what the name, it begins with a D. There's this medieval map of Europe that when you compare it to Ptolemy's map, this medieval map is astonishingly accurate. Ah. I put it in Financial Vipers of Venice, this portolan. You know, this is a 13th century map that looks like a modern map of Europe.
Amazing.
I mean, it's that accurate, all right? Where is this coming from? Well, again, my guess is it's coming from the Imperial Archives in Constantinople, which in turn are coming, in my opinion, most likely from whatever remained of the Library of Alexandria after the burning there.
Okay.
But that still doesn't answer the question. How are you getting something so accurate out of that library when Ptolemy is producing this map of Europe that, you know, perish the thought you'd ever use it to sail a ship or fly on an airplane, you know, because right. You're going to crash into some things here, folks.
Right.
But I think what this really indicates is that this cartographic tradition, ultimately, is coming from high antiquity. And it's coming from high antiquity because of its extreme accuracy, which we have only been able to reduplicate in modern times by very accurate measurement. And here comes the curveball, by satellites.
Yeah.
In other words, it's coming from such extreme antiquity that this is a piece of that information that whatever civilization existed back then, it was at least at a similar pitch of scientific and technical development as we are now.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, that when you look at these maps, that's, in my opinion, these are some of the strongest evidence that we have that this ancient high civilization really existed. People say, well, you know, where's the evidence of this ancient high civilization? Well, look at some of these maps sometime.
Yeah. So one of those maps, the Pere Ries map, depicts Antarctica without any ice.
Yes, that's the other teensy problem.
So how far back do you have to go for that?
Well, that's the other problem. You know, it's showing Antarctica in the right position, and it's showing the coastline of Antarctica more or less. You know, you can go online and read these skeptical sites, you know, where they're coming up with the most outlandish things to try and hold on, you know, desperately
exactly
to the conventional narrative. But the bottom line is they can't explain it, you know. The only hypothesis that can explain it is the one they don't want to deal with, and that's a high civilization in high antiquity, or to give it the dreaded A word, Atlantis.
Right? Yes.
To me, the maps are the clearest indicator that we have, not to mention all these weird structures all over the world that no one can explain how they built these things.
Well, in South America in particular.
Oh, yeah. Pumapunku, you know.
That's a very advanced civilization. So.
It had to have been. Yeah. You know, you can't produce these things without some sort of modern technology. And I'm sorry, you know, the Incas didn't build them.
Exactly.
They'll tell you they didn't build them. You know, to me, this whole thing indicates that there's something. And since we're talking about this, Daniel, the implication here is that the possibility arises that when you're dealing with people like the Templars, or the Hospitallers, mm-hmm. or their Genoese and Venetian allies, that they were aware that this was a tradition that came from high antiquity.
Yeah.
And by the time that the Renaissance breaks out and you have the translation of the Hermetic text, this is when this goes public, because we've got to remember at that time the Hermetica was considered to be dated to an Egyptian period predating the Old Testament. So in other words, to them, this represented primordial knowledge from that high civilization. So the idea goes public. So in other words, I think it's very possible that the maps in particular may have been viewed by these people as evidences and parts of this lost tradition. Absolutely.
And do you think that the maps represent, well, I want to actually go a little deeper on the mystery school's role, because somebody had to preserve these ancient maps and pass them down through secret tradition and keep them hidden and just let certain select groups be aware and be in the loop on these things. So the idea of these mystery schools going back to Egypt, and they would understand all kinds of esoteric knowledge, including special kinds of physics. And you've written about that. So these mystery schools survived underground somehow. But was there a point where they died out? Or do you think they've survived right up to our modern era? And were they behind this major influx of occult and esoteric knowledge that showed up, you know, on the scene, out of the blue, in the late 19th, early 20th century? Is that the mystery schools at work once again?
That's the $64 trillion question, accounting for inflation.
right, yeah.
I'll tell you what my intuition is, and then I'll tell you, give you some details that tend to corroborate it. My intuition is that, yes, we're looking at continuity. Now, the real question is, what kind of continuity are we looking at? Are we looking at continuity merely of ideas? Or are we also looking at continuity of organizations, institutions, and personnel? The latter is much more difficult to prove, obviously, and no one really could prove it, but that is exactly what my intuition is that we're not simply looking at continuity of idea, but we are looking at groups of people who made it their conscious and deliberate covert purpose to preserve this stuff and hand it down. Now, the reason I think that this is a possibility is that you do have, of course, the appearance of the Rosicrucian manifestos in the early 17th century, but you also have a fellow over in England writing a very peculiar treatise.
Yeah.
But this particular fellow, I'm referring to Lord Verulam, Francis Bacon.
Right.
And what does he write? He writes this very weird little work. I have a copy of it called The Advancement of Learning and the New Atlantis.
Nice.
And when you read the New Atlantis, it's a short little treatise. It's an allegory about a secret society that he calls the Temple of Solomon. And the Temple of Solomon is all about this college of very learned men who sit around dreaming up all sorts of scientific projects for the betterment of mankind. You know, here's Francis Bacon, and, you know, he's the Lord High Chancellor, senior advisor to King James, and so on and so forth. And he's coming up with all of this. And then, of course, you have the creation of the Royal Society under King Charles II, which, again, is this very weird occasion, because what's he creating it for and out of? Well, he's creating it out of the Roundheads and the Royalists to kind of unite the parties, you know. Let's not have a replay of chopping off my dad's head here. And he is chartering this to do advanced scientific work. And, oh, by the way, it just turns out that both sides of the Royal Society are full of Masons.
Ah.
Okay? So, in other words, when you look at these types of organizations, you look at these events, you see very clearly that something is going on behind the scenes. There is an effort to recreate, at least, or to update the mystery schools.
Mm-hmm.
Now let me throw a curveball in here. Okay, this is a whopper. I have a little book back here on my shelf that my co-author Scott DeHart and I did in response to our book Transhumanism, because we got lots of, you wouldn't have believed the amounts of emails we got after that book came out. Well, what does this mean? What does that mean? So we decided to do this little book and answer some of these emails.
Okay.
And it's called Transhumanism in Dialogue. It's a little Lulu book that we did. And in it, we point out three gentlemen who made an interesting observation.
Yeah.
The first gentleman is a well-known fellow by the name of René Descartes.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Well, René Descartes wrote a very interesting little thing that in his reading of ancient mathematicians, he thought that he had encountered a form of mathematical analysis that the ancients knew that we don't know and that he thinks they suppressed. Okay? And so, you know, Scott and I are reading this and we think, gee, that's kind of interesting.
Sure.
Because, you know, among many other activities that the good mathematician did, he went off to join the Catholic armies of the Habsburgs at the Battle of White Mountain to defeat the hermetically inspired prince of the Rhineland Palatinate, who was going to bring in the New Age.
That's so odd.
Yeah, that's so odd. You know, why René Descartes, of all people?
He's a mathematician.
And he's a mathematician, you know.
Strange.
You don't think of this guy as a soldier going off.
No, for, definitely
you know,
not.
A Catholic crusade. You know, so in other words, there's another agenda here. And then there's another gentleman, also writing and reading mathematics. And he says, well, you know, Descartes' right. There's something in these ancient mathematicians. It's a hidden form of analysis. We don't know what it is. It's either been lost to history or these guys way back when suppressed it. And we better find out what it is. And his name is Isaac Newton.
Oh.
Oh.
So he knows.
So he knows something's up.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's a third gentleman. And he says, you know what? In reading these guys, I think that they had a form of analysis, and this is the real big one here, this particular guy.
Okay.
I think they had a form of analysis by which they solved all their problems. It was formally explicit. They had an algebraical way of doing this, and it had nothing to do with numbers. And I think I found certain indications of what they were doing, and I'm kind of trying to reconstruct this. And I think they may have suppressed this knowledge. Guess what his name was?
I could guess.
Gottfried Leibniz.
Whoa.
The other inventor of the calculus.
Interesting. Yeah. So they weren't pulling any punches on this.
No, they weren't pulling any punches. They're saying, you know, if you stop and consider what these three mathematicians who've been torturing us ever since are saying, they're saying, okay, there's a hidden form of mathematical analysis. It was lost or suppressed. All three of them agree that it's probably suppressed. And Leibniz is going on to say, oh, and by the way, I think I've kind of figured out some of
it. Unbelievable.
So in other words, what these guys are telling you, there's a hidden tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And all three, interestingly enough, are involved in setting up these scientific colleges and societies.
Right.
All three of them. So in other words, I do think on that basis alone that you're looking at least at the continuity of idea. And when you add into this mix the Masons, the Rosicrucians, the Templars, the odd appearance of the Templars investigating and trying to find hidden knowledge in Palestine and Constantinople and what have you, that yes, these are indicators that there is an organizational continuity of some sort going on.
Yeah.